With that, let's welcome our speaker this morning, Scott.
My name's Scott Redmond. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Scott.
Hi, everybody. And I'm as sick as a dog. And thanks for your patience and your support. Last night, I really, really had a good time. And I've had a great time with Chris so far this morning. I want to welcome all the new people to AA. Happy Father's Day for all you fathers and people who have dads. And I want to say something. I really am going to ask you, I implore you to know that for this workshop, I'm not telling you how to do AA. I have absolutely no idea how you should do Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know the right way to do Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to talk about some very specific things that I do, and I don't think they're right. I don't. I think they are the way. Our book says that I have to find a power greater than myself that will solve my problem, or this hammer lock that this spiritual illness has on me will never loosen its grip, and I'm going to die. And I know that when I hear people talk, I tend to go, yeah, you know, what? Are you, like, even sober? You know, I mean, how do you even what? So I'm sure that will not happen for anybody this morning. But I just want to assure you that if I really felt that I knew how you should do this, I wouldn't be having a really good time here. I really wouldn't be. I'd be pissed off because some of you hadn't changed yet. And you keep acting like you. I've noticed that my wife continues to act like her despite all my efforts. This is a workshop. It's a little different from a regular meeting. I'm going to talk about the inventory process and how I've used it to change. How I've used it to change when I did my initial fourth step and how I've continued to use it to change 20 years in. I regularly blow my life up. I blow it up. And I've blown it up a lot. Sometimes it's been a good explosion, sometimes a bad explosion. But I have, just a couple of years ago, my wife and I talked last night about blowing my life up. I told God I'd be willing to do anything, you know, for a living, and I wound up doing something that I had really not planned on doing. By the way, let me tell you that while I continued to do inventory while I was working as a cook, right before I got sober, I was at my dinner table with my family, and I reached across the table to grab something, and my arm came near my older son, and when my arm went near him, he went like this. It was a reflex, and my heart fell out of me. I couldn't believe that when I came physically close to my son, he had this knee-jerk reaction of repulsion. And now at 26, he sits down next to me and puts his head on my shoulder. And as I continued to do inventory, because I was very resentful at myself working as a cook on a catering truck, I was very resentful at the people who saw me working as a cook on a catering truck. And my son Jesse, you see, the way I thought I was going to get close to Jesse was while we were buffing my Oscars in my Academy Awards. We would get close on Oscar buffing night. And when he was a little boy, what he was really interested in is learning how to cook, because he had seen me cook. So Jesse and I had been cooking together for 20 years. He was at the University of Chicago studying mathematics, and he'd call me and I'd talk him through sauces and stuff like that. And that's what he and I still do today. That's not how I would have elected to get, you know, I would have wanted my son to be involved in the AFI tribute that would be done to me, not learning how to cook with me. You know, it's an interesting thing, and I feel comfortable talking about it. I love your group, and I love your meeting. I just love that meeting. One of the things, and I will really love everything about it, one of the things I really love about it is the applause that you give each newcomer. It's just fantastic. And something happened at your meeting last night that happens at many Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and it took me a while to understand why I found it hurtful. When some people took a chip or a birthday, there was a lot of hooting and very demonstrative stuff. And at first, it used to bother me, and I couldn't figure out why. And I thought, why don't you, like, get the stick out of your butt? You know, why are you so uptight about it? And then, but there was something still. And then I found out why it bugged me. It bugged me is because if we hoot for one person, we need to hoot for everybody. That's what bugs me about it, is that what happens to the people who don't get hoots? And what the deal is, it's a violation of anonymity. For me, it's a violation of anonymity. Anything that brings me out from the crowd and makes me what I'm not really, which is a child of God, a rank-and-file member of Alcoholics Anonymous, the most powerful person in AA, rank-and-file member, you know? The more special you become, the lower you go on the totem until you become trustee, and then you're crap, pretty much. And it's an interesting thing. In terms of my defects of character, I get hungry. When does hunger become gluttony? I have amorous feelings. When does being sensual or amorous or sexual become lust? When does sharing become crosstalk? They are all, to me, for the same reason at the end of the day. Hunger plus power equals gluttony. What I mean by that is if I'm hungry, but I become self-serving, if I start eating at you, if I become ashamed of the way that I look, then I'm exercising godly power over myself or you. It's hunger plus power. If I feel amorous, there's nothing wrong with that, but if it becomes amor plus power, in other words, I'm going to manipulate you to have you, or I'm going to feel ashamed and deprecate myself for not being worthwhile, then it's those feelings plus power. And sharing plus power equals crosstalk. Referring to other people's sharing during a meeting to me is not crosstalk. A good Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, a great Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, is often like an internal combustion engine. It's the sparks, the sharing of the sparks that drive it forward. That you can see it reach critical mass sometimes. You can feel the room bulge sometimes as it builds and feeds off each other. But when I when my sharing plus power, which means I'm having a one-sided conversation with you, I'm using this as a bully pulpit, I'm being didactic or pedantic, I'm being even, you see, to me, there was crosstalk if you talked bad about me from the podium. Then there's good crosstalk when you talk nicely about me from the podium. I never seem to have a problem with that. But they're both crosstalk, because then I'm a little more special than the rest of the people here. At any rate, I'm getting sidetracked, but I think in a delightful way. I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years by the time I got to AA. You told me I was going to get involved in self-examination. And I thought, well, this is my area. I think this is going to be great. I think I'm going to really be able to bring something to the table here. And I think whoever guides me through this is going to be very fortunate, because I'm so steeped in this material, I really feel I'm going to enrich their experience of this. And then I got the horrible news. The horrible news is in here. I want to read to you what used to be my favorite sentence from the Big Book of AA. It's in the fifth chapter. It's on page 65, and it continues on page 66. I used to read this sentence and then just go to sleep. They're assuming that you're looking at a list of the wrongs that have been done to you. They're assuming you've written a list of people who have tried to have you committed to mental institutions, people who have screwed you at work, people who have been thinking behind your back. Hard to catch them, but you can do it. They're assuming that you're looking at this list, and they say, upon looking at this list, here it comes, the first thing apparent was the world and its people were often quite wrong. That's enough for today. Don't read the next two pages. Don't read them. And I'll tell you why. Because what the next two pages say is that so beautifully, they just don't argue with a drunk. They never argue with a drunk. They don't say that you haven't been screwed. They say you've been screwed terribly. You're right and you're dead. You're right and you're dead because you experience the wrongdoing of others in a way that is so injurious, in a way that eclipses everything good in your life, that you actually die from it. So what are we going to do now? You're right and you're dead. What a gorgeous thing that is. It says we know a way out. And this was the worst news in the world for me, this way out, because it is moral psychology. It's the turn from my psychology, which treated me psychologically but didn't treat me spiritually. Here's the turn that they make. They say, we're not only going to see what the problem is, we're not only going to examine it and see what's been creating anxiety, but now we're going to see what's in you that you can resolve, that you can bring to a higher power, because nothing else has ever resolved this to you, for you. No amount of talking it. I always, one of the things I always get the willies for when I go to a meeting, somebody says, I'm going to talk this to death. I've heard that phrase. I don't know if you've heard that phrase. And I always go, why take me with it? That this notion that if I air it enough, somehow it's going to get resolved. For me, that simply hasn't been true. It might be for the other person. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy for me after a while. But I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but when a new person comes to a meeting and says, my sponsor told me I should share at every meeting, and I always think, then why isn't he here? Why isn't he here listening to this? Why us? Why us? If you're going to say that, you got to follow the guy around, okay? I'm just saying. It'll be used a lot less, believe me. I once sponsored a guy. I didn't sponsor him. This is what happened. There was a guy at my group who was such a blowhard that when he shared, people threw nooses over rafters. People hung themselves. It was unbelievable. And he walked up to me after a meeting one day, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, you know what, you really have not been there for me, and I'm really going to move on with sponsorship. I had no recollection of him ever asking me to sponsor him, ever. So I just got the good part. I got fired. And that was my only experience of sponsoring this guy. I was getting fired. At any rate, what is it in me that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone? I have to put aside the wrongdoing of others completely, absolutely and completely, in order to get the vice grip of this spiritual sickness off of me, in order to start breathing again, in order to have an inclusive life instead of an exclusive life. Now, I've heard people say many times in AA that the road gets narrower as I get here, and I understand what they're saying, and I appreciate it. It's just, that's not a sentiment that I gravitate to. That's not a way I want to live. I want to be, the book talks about the broad highway. Come join us on the broad highway. Become part of the great idea, the great reality, the big idea. Join us on the firing line of life. Help us to pack things into the mainstream of life. It talks about life getting bigger, more inclusive. And I really like that paradigm a lot. That's really how my life, that how I've experienced Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm resentful at Scott for being loaded on heroin the night that his father died. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. What are the defects of character in me that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone? I'm not living in today. I'm a grudge holder. I'm filled with shame and guilt. I'm playing God. I'm not trusting in God. I have unreasonable expectations. What was I supposed to do at that time? I woke up and I got loaded. That's what I do. I'm resentful at my father for dying. What a horrible thing to admit. Horrible thing to admit. It affects all five. What are the defects in me? Playing God. Ungrateful. I had my father till I was 21. A lot of people never have a dad. Irresponsible, because if I hadn't been so irresponsible about how I was behaving at that time, I probably wouldn't have all these feelings. Not living in today because I was going to suffer for the rest of my life. And one of my defects, which has just been, really has been a very, very difficult one for me, that I benefit so much from when I pray and meditate on it and get some relief, is I'm unwilling to accept the fact that Scott is a child of God who's spiritually sick. And hand in hand with that is I am unwilling to accept the fact that you are a child of God who could be spiritually sick like me. You know, and I, last week my wife, you know, I said something about something I wanted to do with my career, and my wife went, well, sure, go ahead, do that, and we won't be able to blank. And I looked at her and I said, boy, you would never say something like that to one of your sponsees. And she went, you are right, and I am sorry. I would let my sponsee say it. I'd appreciate it. And later on, if they were boneheaded enough to do it, we'd deal with it. But I'd give them some oxygen in the room. And I'm not trying to vilify Nancy. That's something I do to her, too. How great that we can talk about that, you know. So I read that to a sponsor, and I go to God in 6 and 7, and I say, Pop, please remove this self-seeking. Please remove this unwillingness to accept spiritual sickness in myself. Please remove this shame. Please remove this guilt. And sometimes something appears to me. Sometimes an action appears to me. And quite often I just experience that prayer. I just experience that prayer and then go on with the treatment. The treatment are these actions. These actions which, I got to tell you, you know, quite often we hear that faith without works are dead, which I really understand. But I also really get that works without faith are dead. That if I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm walking the walk and I'm doing commitments and I'm doing all that stuff and it's not tethered, if it's not moored to a spiritual endeavor, it's a lot of noise. And I just wind up with great tunnel sobriety. I just wind up pissed off at other groups. They don't do it right. I'm doing it right. I'm an AA. I'm over sober, you know, and I'm doing X, Y, and Z. And I want to tell you, at this point, it's not pretty to me. And also, then I will tend to make an identity of being really the guy who really knows who is doing that and who is not. It's endless. At any rate, when I did my initial inventory, I had a lot of material about my father, about my children, about my wife, about being a bad employee. I had a fear list. There are 3 sections of the inventory. You're asked to write 4 times. Twice on resentments. A list of resentments with 3 columns and a defect of character list. The second time we're asked to write is a fear list. And we're asked, and it's a real interesting kind of a tricky thing. It says, write fears not in connection with personal resentment. Now, I could make, if I wanted to dot all the I's and cross all the T's, I could make a case for every single fear I have being tethered to a personal resentment. But I want to go with the spirit of the law and not the letter of the law. I'm scared of being alone. I'm scared of being with people. I'm scared of success. I'm scared of failure. I'm scared. I had this in my inventory. I'm scared of being cut by newspaper. I mean, if you really get all your fears down, there's very few fears that somebody will admit to you that you'll think they're nuts. Because of, you know, I mean, I had fears down there that I'd read and I go, oh, you live in a psychological theme park. Oh, no. People, institutions, and principles. I'm resentful at the South African government. I'm resentful at homophobes. I'm resentful at racists. I'm resentful at the state of Israel, and I'm Jewish. That was fun. And I wrote a fear list, and I wrote sexual inventory. And the second paragraph on page 69, it says, I suggest that I write about 7 individual things about each situation where I've created a problem or created harm. Where have I been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, unjustifiably aroused jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness? And what should I do instead? Not what could I do, what should I do? What could I do? Well, what I did. What should I do? Something vastly different. And in the next 2 paragraphs on 69, I believe is one of the most astute, beautiful descriptions of moral psychology. Moral psychology is a term that Silkworth uses in the beginning of the book, where he says, we long suspected that some form of moral psychology would be necessary. It's self-examination with a moral application and a plan of action based on that moral application. It's a vastly, vastly different enterprise than psychotherapy. And that's why when I hear people comparing the two, I think it's unfortunate. It's really saying that Rome's a nicer town than London. They're very different. At any rate, it says that in this way I try to shape a sound ideal for my future. It says sex life. I say my future life. When I write what I should have done instead, it's the guy I want to be. It's the man I'd like to be. That's the man that I'd like to be. So when I hold my sons, when I talk to my sons, when my sons come to me, I don't have any shadow back here. I'm current. I'm free. I'm with them. And And that goes for the men that I sponsor and the people I encounter in the course of my life. So I did this big inventory, this initial inventory. I started it when I was 6 months sober. I finished it when I was nine. It took me 11 and a half hours to read. The shortest inventory I've ever heard as a sponsor was 15 minutes, and the longest was 22 hours. They're both dead. I just don't think it matters how long the document is if it's not followed by a continuation of taking inventory. It's been my experience that it doesn't matter. That's what the 10 steps for in my book is, to continue taking personal inventory. If I had remembered everything in that initial inventory, I would have looked like an outtake from the movie Scanners. My head would have blown up. It just would have blown up. I don't really believe that I could have dealt with all. I couldn't fit all the pain in my head. And I read this inventory to my sponsor. It was a profound experience to me. I talked last night about the kind of experience I had reading that Resentment Against Nazis, about finding out, realizing the difference between the event and the resentment was an absolutely life-changing experience for me. And it has been so helpful to me with men that I sponsor. Another thing that's been very interesting for me is sponsoring, because I live with a committed member of Al-Anon, and because I have so many friends in Al-Anon and have attended so many meetings and listened to so many Al-Anon speakers. And if you're an AA member and haven't exposed yourself to Al-Anon, I believe you're missing a great, great gift. The men I sponsor who grew up in alcoholic homes have a little something extra that I don't have. I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. I just grew up in a psychotic home. But it's different than growing up in an alcoholic home. And it's been my experience, not all, but some of the men that I sponsor who come from alcoholic homes, they've got something extra to deal with. And if we don't deal with it, eventually they stop doing 12-step work, some of them, because they've got that idea, that awful idea that the alcoholic is never telling the truth, is always going to get over on them. They deal with a lot of, and I have gotten tremendous gifts of really throwing that on the table and discussing it and looking at it through the inventory process, and it's freed a lot of guys up to do service who perhaps wouldn't have done service. I went on about my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started doing the 10th step. About 6 months before I got sober, my older brother, who's 2 years older than me, came to visit us. And shortly after his visit, he wrote me a letter. It was about a 5-page single-space letter, which was an indictment of me, just explaining what an abominable person I was and a horrible husband. And I got the letter, and I asked him. It was a complete shock to me, and because we had had, I thought, a very good relationship, really up until including the last time I'd seen him. And he refused to talk to me about it. He said, "I'm writing you another letter," and I said, Please don't write me another letter. At any rate, when I got to the inventory process and through it, and I got through 6 and 7, my initial blush of 6 and 7, I was really anxious to talk to my brother, to make amends to him for whatever I had done. And he wouldn't return my phone calls. And so I eventually wrote him a letter saying, whatever I've done, I'm really deeply sorry for it. And he wrote me back a letter, and the letter said, "If you don't owe me anything. If you live to be a million and you're sorry every day of that million years, you wouldn't even come close to being sorry enough." So I called my sponsor and I read him the letter. And God bless him, he said, "Rip it up right now." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because if you don't, you might reread it." And I ripped it up on the phone and he said, "Good work. I love you and I'm really proud of you." And I moved on through my life. My brother stopped talking to me. He wouldn't talk to me, and he wouldn't talk to my mother. He broke relationships with our entire family. For my mother, this is a point of terrible suffering from her. She's a very troubled woman. She's a very sad, very depressed woman. And she, for anybody, it's got to be very difficult for a child to refuse to talk to her. And for somebody who has made an identity of being miserable, if you're quiet, you could actually hear her sighing right now, actually. She lives in the Bronx. My mother, if you ask me to describe her, you know there's a phrase people say, "Well, we'll worry about that later." If you say that to my mother, she'd go, "Okay, get your book out, like Tuesday at 9, that's good." and couple of years later, you know, nice things were happening with my kids, and the resentment would come up. I'm resentful at Mitchell for not talking to me and not having anything to do with my children. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, sex. What are the defects? The defects are stubborn, people pleaser. I want them to like me. Spiritual pride. I'm a really nice guy. Why don't you want to talk to me? Not living in today. Who knows what can happen? And ungrateful. I'm surrounded by guys. I've got a million brothers in Alcoholics Anonymous. And time went by, and we're talking through 10 years, you know, and now the boys are graduating high school and big stuff is happening, and it erupts again. Every couple of years, it kind of erupts again. Now something different appears on the defect of character list. What appears is ungrateful, because why do I want my sons to have contact with this guy? What am I wishing on my sons? This is a very, very troubled guy. Who knows what they would go through if they had to be in contact with him? And I got a lot of relief there. And then 15 years into my sobriety, I was working with a new sponsor. And it erupted again. Again, something happened. I think one of my kids graduated college or something like that. Something came up again. And something wonderful happened for me. What appeared on the list was what I got was, okay, why doesn't he want to talk to me? I'm really a great guy. People all over the country like me. I'm a spiritual Goliath. I mean, listen to two of my tapes and call me in the morning, right? I'm just, you know, people would, you know, I know guys would love to sign up to be my brother. Putting the wrongdoing of others completely out of my mind. What if it is so injurious to have contact with me, to him? But, what if it is so injurious? What if it hurts so much to be in contact with me? Who am I to deny him that blessing? And I got it. I got it. The only reason that I would deny him that blessing is because I need that thing. I need that. I need that. I need him to see that. You know, he's the boy in the bubble. If you go outside of the bubble, you'll be killed by the microbes. Whatever that is. Whatever that is. And I got it. I got it. And about 2 months ago, I got a call telling me that my brother was dead. And he had died from a virulent, very fast-acting form of blood cancer. And I just wept. I mean, I wept because I was able to mourn my brother without making an identity of being a rejected brother. That's really what it comes down to. I got to just say, oh, my God, I don't love you because I don't know who you were. I haven't talked to you in 20 years. I have an idea of you. That's my attachment. My attachment is to my idea of you, not you. I don't know who you were. 20 years later, I mean, me 20 years ago, a vastly different person. But I have this wonderful, sweet memory of this guy who I shared a room with, who I adored, who I experienced being a kid with, who I experienced being terrified with, who was also terribly cruel and mean to me, broke my head 3 times, smashed a jar over my head. I could just take the whole thing in and say, Pop, I love my brother. I'm so sad he's gone. This also does not remove a piece of my life. It removes a huge piece of my mother's life, because I can say really with some degree of certainty that my mother has made an identity of this and has craved him almost on a daily basis. And that has not been true for me. So there's no part of really a big part of my life per se that's missing. This has been the result of the 10th step, of continuing to re-examine through this inventory process and pry it open and change. Otherwise, I would have been locked into some other stuff. Well, how can I change? Maybe if I sponsor just one more guy I don't like, you know, that'll be the demonstration. No, I sponsor enough guys I don't like. I'm just kidding. Into sobriety, about 10 years of sobriety, I found myself in a really untenable position. I had been part of a group of AA. It's a great group of AA, and I really needed to get out of it. I had made some tacit agreements about my sobriety that were killing me, and they were basically okay, you chase women, you gamble, I'll overeat, you do that, but we're sober, we're okay. And it was really, the ice was really starting to get thin for me. I was up over 300 pounds. I was terrified of my wife. Not because she's terrifying, just because I was terrified. And I got another sponsor and I moved on to another home group. I'm resentful at Scott for being overweight. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. What are the defects of character in God, in me, that if God would remove the resentment, would be gone? Well, I'm self-serving. I'm gluttonous. I'm ashamed. I'm not living in today. I'm stubborn. Okay, so I went to God in 6 and 7. I asked for the removal of the defects. I said, Pop, what do I need to do? And my inner voice said, go to OA. And I said, what else you got? And I'm willing. What else do you have? So I do the inventory, read it to my sponsor, go out and have a bowl of spaghetti and a pie. And what does this have to do with sobriety? Absolutely nothing unless you're going through it. Absolutely nothing unless you're traveling all over the world, talking at AA meetings, and the worst moment in your life is when you have to walk the 10 feet from the chair to the podium. Absolutely nothing. Happy, joyous, and free. We do not believe that this life is a veil of tears. I want the whole thing. I'm not asking to, you know, my ideal weight is my birth weight, okay? that's not what I'm asking for. I'm just asking for to have a reasonable body and a reasonable life and not be cut off from other people, which is how I feel right now, you know? But I didn't feel it then, you know? And it says in 6 and 7, we go over the first 5 propositions in the book before we go to 6 and 7. This has been the key for me. This has been the fire-starting moment. Because I initially did that with my fourth step. But now when I do 10, when I have recidivism, which I believe the attorneys in the crowd will tell me that recidivism is a bad thing. It's not just repeating. It's a bad thing. It's chronic wrongdoing, right? Okay. that when I continue to examine these things and continue to repeat them, whatever it is that's cutting me off from my higher power and not allowing me to really be part of the deal here. Chris and I really have a good time together. We have fun together. There's a connection that happens, and it's a spiritual thing because we talk a lot about AA and stuff. How crazy is it to think that when you take Chris and I out of the equation that this thing disappears? This is the face and the breath of God. This is what's in the room right now. This is the thing that happens here. This is the thing that people, you know, people of religion, many of whom have a good idea, have been talking about for centuries. It's what the Buddhists talk about, you know. The Buddhists say there's 3 kinds of suffering. One's a dual kind of suffering, my personal favorite, which is craving mental and physical comfort, my favorite suffering. And then there's wanting things to stop and wanting things to never stop. And those are the 3 sources of suffering, of attachment. It's called dukkha, and what the translation of the word dukkha means is a wheel that's not set right, that doesn't move right when the vehicle goes forward. And I can say that those 3 sources of suffering have been my major source of disconnection. So I go through the first 5 propositions in the book with this problem of food that I've been having. Is it because I'm told, go over the first 5 propositions. Now I'm applying it to a specific deal that I'm not getting movement on that is killing me. Is it step 1? Am I not really admitting that I'm powerless over food, that my life's unmanageable around food? Is it step 2? Do I not really believe that God will restore me to sanity in this situation? God can keep Saturn on its axis, but he can't order lunch for me. Is it step... is it's just too big a job for him. One of the things that just used to drive me crazy, and it doesn't drive me crazy anymore, I just know it's not right. It's when I used to hear in meetings that it's all the same disease. No, it's only the same disease if you have it. I'm allergic to food. I eat a loaf of toast for breakfast. I mean, I this is what I go straight to. I'm allergic to certain foods. I can't stop. It's the same as alcohol. At any rate, Or is it step three? Have I not really made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God in that situation? Or is it step four? Have I not done enough inventory? Have I really? Or is it step five? It says in our book, that in the description of step five, that sometimes newcomers have kept facts about themselves, which later they drank over. So I go over the first five propositions in the book. In this situation with food, or in this situation with work, or in this situation with sex, or in this situation with my relationship, and I go, where is it? Where's my experience here? How can I demonstrate? How can I work step one in a more robust, fuller way? How can I surrender more completely? And I went to OA because it was the, for me, it was a huge demonstration. And I went to OA and I said, you know, I'm a circuit speaker. And they said, yeah, and a very fat circuit speaker, by the way. And I said, would you like me to speak? I said, no, 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 and your mouth's full, so don't. And I got relief. I got relief about work. Work was just killing me. I had to change careers 5 years ago. And my sponsor, Paul, I called him up and I was just weeping. I realized I was actually, because when I would take non-show business jobs, I would take them and let the employer know. It was the kind of job that I could leave. And I had two kids in college, and I had to get another career. And I was resentful at show business for not giving me... I got to tell this other story real quick before I do this. When I was working on the kitchen truck, one day, and I had done a lot of inventory, the kind of inventory work I'm talking about, the first five propositions in the book, you know, finding other ways to demonstrate. And... I was on a movie set. Now, again, you make a lot of dough, but you do everything. So when the meal's over, if you're the chef, you're cleaning up. You're just covered with crap, you know. And on this set of this big movie I was catering, a guy who had worked as a stage manager on the last sitcom I had directed walked onto the set, and I went and I hid behind the truck. And I said to myself, you're either going to hide behind this truck for the rest of your life, or you're going to go out there and do your job. And I got it. And I went out and I started to clean up, and Lenny walked over to me and said, Scott, how you doing? And I said, fine. He was really glad to see me. I was glad to see him. And I knew that I was free because of that. Now, on a movie set, when the director screams at the first, at the assistant director, the assistant screams at the second screams at the third assistant director, and the third assistant director says, where's the goddamn caterer? And he goes and screams at him. So I'd have kids, you know, nine-year-old kids screaming at me. And I would think, and I had to do inventory on this, I'd think, you know, someday you're going to come in and meet your new boss, and it's going to be me. And it's going to be fun. And a couple of years later, I was back, I was directing sitcoms, back directing sitcoms, which I did for years, and wrote screenplays for major studios. And I was on the lot, and this guy, a crew member, a grip, and grips make sure everything's okay on a movie set. And he came up to me and said, oh, you're that caterer. You're such a great guy. What are you doing on the lot? And I said, well, I'm directing the show on stage 36. And he said, did you go right from the catering to the directing? Did you just, he was sensing a new career path at that point. But I was interviewing staff for this. I was the staff director on the sitcom. And they brought in an assistant director. And then he walked on the stage. He looked up. And I saw in his eyes, he went, not the caterer. Oh, no, no. And a little shiver went through him. And I didn't have to punish him because I had done the work. But I really enjoyed the shiver a lot. I really, just that little thing. He didn't know what he had done for me in that little. At any rate. I was resentful at show business for not having a place for me anymore. I was resentful at myself for not being gifted enough to be successful in show business. I was resentful at myself for being a loser. And then I had a lot of different personalities who wouldn't give me work, and I was resentful at them for cutting me out, and I was resentful at them for being successful. And if I hadn't done this inventory work later on in my career, in my life, I really don't know where I would have been. I think I would have gone mad. I know that I would have started hating Alcoholics Anonymous for not working. That I know. And I went back to the first five propositions in the book, and it really became clear to me that I had to stop complaining about this. I had to take it from a complaint to a real piece of business. My entire life, I have alcoholism, and my alcoholism would stay above the horizon as a real piece of business for a very brief amount of time. Sometimes it would stay aloft because something great had happened. I'd fall in love, out of love. I'd get a job, lose a job. It would stay as a real piece of business, but it's on my own juice. So eventually it's going to go below the horizon, and I'm going to act without reason, without explanation. I'm going to act insanely. And what has happened for me since April 22nd, 1985, is my alcoholism has stayed above the horizon as a real piece of business all of that time. And here's the miracle. The miracle is that it's happening even when I'm not concentrating on it, even when I'm not staring at it, because it's buoyed on the heads and shoulders of the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous and the higher power that you've introduced me to. That's a miracle. And what my goal has become in sobriety is these problems like food, like career, like these other things that have gone below the horizon, and I act without reason, without explanation. I want to have that kind of profound experience. That profound experience, which after a while stops being profound, it just starts being your achievement, the achievement of this thing that's come into my heart, you know. My sponsor, you know, when I made this decision to go into sales, and I was weeping on the phone with him, and he said to me, "I'm going to tell you how spiritually developed I am." And I said, "Oh, please do." And he said, "When you find out that this is like the best thing that ever happened to you, I'm not going to rub it in." And I don't know that it's the best thing that's ever happened to me. I do know that I still write. I'm involved in a writing project right now. If I don't write, I get sick. I've been very successful in business. I have not had a write of resentment against myself for being financially responsible in 3 years. And I used to have to write those all the time. I've gotten tremendous relief. So that's really, we've got about a half hour left. I want to open up for questions and answers, but that's some of my experience with the inventory process, 4 through 7, that I had when I initially practiced it, and as I continue to practice it as a tool for change in AA. So thank you. Any questions? Do I have crap on my forehead? Yeah. Before I do, I'd like to talk briefly about one of the most troubling defects that I have had inside and out in sobriety and before I got sober, and it's the defect of mind reading. I think that I know what people are thinking, and they're never thinking anything good. They never are. I never catch people thinking, "Wow, you're pimpy. I like you." They're always thinking, "You're a peckerhead, man. And I'm better than you, and you don't know what you're doing." My wife once said to me, "You're not a mind reader. You're barely a mind user." Which really hurt my feelings. So mind reading is one. Selfish, self-centered, and self-seeking. I like that. It's a disease of self. And when I talk to God, I like to be as specific as I can be. Selfish is wanting it all for me. Self-seeking is trying to figure out what's in it for me. And self-centered is figuring it's all about me. Self-pity, probably. I think if you bottled self-pity, it would knock crack off the market in a week. It's just better. Get a little lump in your throat. You lean forward. Eyes water. It's available all the time. Guilt and shame, you know, shame is kind of, "I'm sorry for what I did," and guilt is, "I'm sorry for what I'm doing." I think there's a time element there. Playing God and not trusting in God. This was really upsetting when my sponsor suggested this. Nosy. Ooh, nosy. I make stuff about me or kind of get involved in stuff that I shouldn't get involved in. Also, and one of my friends will get a kick out of this, one of my sponsees has a terrible marriage. they don't know how to fight. They don't. There's a lot of lawyering that goes on. I'll give you the Scott Redmond. This is the real Scott Redmond couples workshop. I'll just give it to you right now. Talk to her until she changes her mind. Just talk to her until her eyes roll back in her head and she keels over, and on the way over she goes, oh, okay. I mean, have you ever done that? You just talk to the other person until they go, whatever. Whatever. Just shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up. I used to get that a lot. People pleasing and mind reading go together quite often for me. In the last couple of weeks, I went through something. It's had a really fantastic impact on my marriage. I have been dealing my whole life with a basic, horrible assessment of myself. Really, just miserable, miserable assessment of myself. And I still have this nagging sort of attitude of, hi, my name's Scott, I'm a knucklehead. I really do. My name's Scott, I'm sorry. Really. We'll get to why later. And it's had a really bad impact on my marriage all these years. And after writing about it and praying about it, I just felt like my back was broken, and I was just done with being ashamed, with the defect of shame. I realized that the defect of shame, if I took a look at the anatomy of it, what the anatomy of shame in my marriage is I'm scared that she's going to be mad at me. I'm scared that this is going to translate into no sex in the upcoming millennium. I am scared that I'm going to be punished. I'm scared I'm going to be disapproved of. That shame in that moment in my relationship, if I break it down, is about 10 different kinds of fear. And what I did was I started asking myself to do something that I have asked my sons to do, that I've asked my sponsees to do, which has been, please don't dance for me. Don't. You don't have to dance for me. I love you. I love my sons. You don't have to dance for me. My sponsor said, try to be an enthusiastic, interested observer instead of a psychotic participant. What a beautiful thing. And I try to do that with my wife. Don't dance for me, my sponsees. And in the last month, 20 years in the last month, I really feel like I'm stopping dancing. And it's great. Any other questions? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which then makes me worried that I'm in denial of my resentment.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I have some resentments on my mother. You know,
mm-hmm.
My mother.
I don't like your mother.
Yeah, my mother. But now I have this feeling of, I understand my mother.
Right.
I understand how she was and why she was. So, am I just in denial?
Absolutely not. This is a fantastic question, okay? There's a difference. Don't confuse something. And I used to confuse it, too. And I've been I deal with this with so many men I sponsor. Just because you're not experiencing the resentment now doesn't matter. The whole architecture of spiritual sickness is it's opportunistic. So when the time and place comes for it to erupt and be applied to a wrongdoing that's going on, believe me, you'll feel them. All right? How wonderful that you're not experiencing them now. Put them through the God computer. Process them. Write it down and admit it, and then do the prayer and meditation. Do the step. Don't be concerned with feeling it now. If you felt it all now, you would blow up, okay? So don't be concerned with not feeling it now. It doesn't mean they're not there. It doesn't mean that the time and place is not going to come where they are going to present and present horribly. Because remember the last paragraph of chapter 3, the time and place will come where we will have no mental defense. And we don't know when that's going to be. But I know that when that mental defense wasn't there, I know what I did. I drank, and now I don't, because my not drinking muscle's so strong. So this is a great question, and I just want to urge you to go through the process, whether or not you're feeling them right now. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, but how great that you're getting relief right now, but long-term relief, permanent recovery, that's a whole different deal. So it's a great question. I have had things that have come that have presented to me years into sobriety that I haven't remembered. You know, where I call my sponsor and I've said, "Have I told you about it?" And he went, "No, you never have." You know, resentments, fears, and sexual misconduct. You know, some people have said to me, "Well, I haven't hurt anybody." And I've said, "Have you hurt yourself?" And they go, "Yeah, I have." You know, it's a funny thing about dishonesty as a defect. I used to lie when there was a lull in a conversation just to keep things moving along. And I have such a knee-jerk reaction to lie. I still have to keep a governor on it. I'll find myself completing a conversation going, "You were never in the army. You, what are you talking about?" So getting in the habit of that self-examination and that admission, it's been the only key to attaining any humility, and without humility, I can't possibly stay sober. But that was a great question. Anybody else?
You mentioned the resentment of yourself in various aspects.
Yeah.
I don't know much about that. I'm more into blame than guilt.
Gotcha. That's a great question. I had a tremendous amount of resentment against myself, and some of my 10 steps these days, no one appears on them except for me. It's been my experience, and this is just me, and I know a lot of people have a lot of different experience in a lot of ways. I've never deliberately gone in to make amends to myself. I was not on my 8-step list, and a lot of people need to be on their 8-step list. I didn't need to be, and I don't indict anybody who does. That being said, so working through those resentments against myself and helping men do that has not been part of that deal for me. I have sponsored guys who have experienced things in their life that are beyond description, have been brutalized and victimized and molested and abused in ways that are beyond comprehension for me. They're so horrible. I'll just give you one example. I sponsor a guy who his mother was so crazy that when he was about 3, she made him sleep in the same bed with her, but before they went to bed, she would look at him and say, "I might kill you tonight." What am I to say to this guy? What can I possibly? I'm coming to him with these pathetic tools in the face of this mind-boggling thing. So we sit down and we go, he says, "I'm resentful at myself for not being a good son." What do you do? Well, what you don't do is you don't throw your chair back and say, "You're wrong, you were a great son." You don't say you don't feel that way. You don't argue with the drunk. You go, "Let's look at the interior of this. I resent myself for not being a good son. What are the defects?" Well, the defects are self-delusion. Not being delusionary. There's a difference between the two. Self-delusion is lying to myself. Being delusionary is telling you I'm going out of space as a young Filipino woman. All right, could happen. They got a lot of stuff doctors can do now. So self-delusion, shame, guilt, unpitying, not showing yourself any love or pity, not living in today because you're accessing this terrible misinformation that was given to you. Now, if a guy writes those defects down, which are a very wonderful kindness to himself, and admits them to you, and then can say to God, please, Pop, please let me appreciate this terrible thing. Look what I'm doing, and it's blocking me. And also the self-pity and all this other stuff. So there's been a myriad of ways, Carl, where I've really benefited so much from this. My sponsor, when he first showed me how to do a fourth step, he asked me every time I wrote a resentment to ask myself the question, do you have any resentment against yourself in connection with this? Well, I was resentful of my father for dying, and I was certainly resentful of myself for not showing up when he died. I was resentful at my sons for being a mess, and I was resentful at myself for being a bad dad. So I found that sort of using that as a tool, really, you know, when your dentist probes around with that awful tool and they find a little pinprick and they open it up and it's like this, the Carlsbad cavern is in there. And I have found that to be true with some of the spiritual work. I'll find a little kernel, the pith of something, and then it opens up into this other thing. So I hope that's helpful. Anybody else? Chris.
Do you do anything in terms of living in 6 and 7 and cooperating with that process beyond just the two paragraphs in the book?
Yeah, 6 and 7 have led me to an examination of 11. Because I have these problems that are ongoing, and I've continued to suffer in certain ways in sobriety. I've had great joy, great pleasure in sobriety, but I've also had problems that have reappeared that I would like to be shut of. In the 12 steps of AA, the only two steps that there are no specific written instructions on are the first two steps in AA. There are no specific work that's they're contained in the first three propositions in the book. They are but of course we focus on them a lot because without them we have really nothing. We're just pissing into a gale force wind. So, and they're the first three propositions of the book. A lot of talk. A lot of people do workbooks and writing assignments, which I think is all fabulous. A lot of people pray about them. So, but for the rest of the 10 steps, there's no suggestion on how to meditate. There's nothing there. There's very specific stuff to do about every other step. There's prayers throughout the entire book. There's many suggestions on prayer, but they were told to pray and meditate. In the section on step 11 and the 12 and 12, they actually give a few examples, which were never very helpful to me at all. About visualizing a sunlit beach. They're not stupid things to do, but they would never. And so 15 years into sobriety, I'm working 11 and a half steps. I guarantee you, if you gave me 12 pills to take, I would take every one of them pills. But I'm taking 11 and a half pills. And in my effort to work 6 and 7, and Paul had started to do with me, and then Bob, who became my sponsor after that, after my sponsor passed away, took me further to really, really starting to meditate and really become much more of a deliberate seeker. And so he took me to Eckhart Tolle. He took me to Pema Chodron, who's a Buddhist nun. He took me to Anthony DeMello, who's a wonderful Jesuit priest who has incredible teachings. And all of these implementations and learning how to meditate, making meditation part of my life. I started by committing to meditating 30 seconds a day. And I meditated 30 seconds a day for a couple weeks, and then I committed to a minute. And now it's part of my life, you know. Not every day. Anthony DeMello has this great story in his tapes where he says, this other priest told, it was an elderly man, and he said to DeMello that in 60 years of his spiritual work, never once had he had ever missed his period of meditation. And DeMello says, sounds like an obsession. And what had happened to me was my prayers and my implementation of 6 and 7 were starting to become hastily mumbled prayers. And when they weren't hastily mumbled, they were flattening out for me. I was having a hard time getting some real penetration with it. Now, I don't ask for that all the time, but I need it. And so as I did 6 and 7, and I went through the first five propositions in the book, and I made it more robust, and I started changing in my life, and I needed more tools to change, really getting involved in the second half of the 11th step and really seeking spiritual teachings, which I needed because the book didn't, they just told me I needed to meditate. And I have found nothing that would injure my experience of Alcoholics Anonymous in any of this stuff. So there's some stuff in some of these teachings where they talk about stuff that would be just insane for an alcoholic. You know, they say, if you do this and this, you should not have certain problems. And I go, no, I like the relaxing thing, you know. So I hope that's helpful. Got time for one more. Yeah.
Yes. When you do an annual inventory, or say you start with a sponsor, you just mentioned the example of your brother, but if a person keeps coming up on your inventory list, or if they keep showing up, how do you resolve that spiritually?
Really the way that I've described it. I number one, I don't do a yearly inventory. I do inventories all the time. I don't do a daily inventory. I do it when I get lit up. There are certain things now, you know, the book says that I'll be able to deal with situations that used to baffle me. And I know, man, there are things that come up that would have lit me up like a Roman candle a year ago, and they'll come up now, and I'll feel them pass over me. After my brother died, I needed to go to New York and tell my mom that her son was dead. Ugh. And I knew that I needed to hold her while I told her. I needed to get on a plane. So I didn't tell her. I made some excuse up about going to New York. And the other thing that I wanted to do was something I had not done, which was find out about my brother's life. The thing I wanted to be able to tell his mother was how he had died, if he was alone, what had happened. I really felt that it was a real kindness for me to be able to have that information for her. So I contacted some people who I knew my brother knew. Because I had asked my friends not to give me any information about my brother. I was not interested in having a relationship with him that way. And I found out that he had died of multiple myeloma. I found out that he had become married. And I found out a bunch of stuff about him. So I then did the thing I didn't want to do and I knew I had to do because of the life I lead now. Through this third person, I extended myself to his wife. And I said, please tell Mitchell's wife that if she would like to have any contact with us, it would be my pleasure. And I knew, I mean, I so did not want to do this. So the message comes back to me the next day. And the message is, she doesn't want. And also there had been some mention of a memorial. And I said, if there would be any interest in me being involved in the memorial or any. So the message comes back to me the next day saying, no, she does not want any contact with you. And the memorial is just for a few people who he really liked. So my first blush was, oh, you son of a bitch. He got me one more time. One more time. He just got me. And what happened was, and my wife was sitting with me, and I just went, oh. And I felt it wash over me, and I was done. I had done too much work. I had experienced the touch of the master's hand in this area too profoundly. And what a great thing that I could feel it and that, you know, that it was done. So that's been my experience when I've really effectively gotten God involved. And then I have certain things that I have created attachments to. There's a couple of people in AA who don't like me. And they've been, I know they don't like me because they've told me. And they reiterate that point whenever they see me as best they possibly can. And I've developed this mania to get these guys to like me. And now what one of my teachings, because of my involvement in the 11th step connected to 6 and 7, is one of my teachers has suggested that I, instead of experience this, that I observe myself experiencing it. That I separate from it as I would with a sponsee and I go, oh, Scott, look at that. You adorable guy. You're adorable. Look at you. You nut. And at first, I'm going, look at you, you nut, you know. And now I go, look at you, you nut, you know. I was told early on, you know, sometimes they say if you resent somebody, pray for them. It says in our book also that we cannot will these things away any more than alcohol. And sometimes a prayer is a wish for me. just doesn't work, you know. And I know that praying for people does work. It does, it has never worked for me, because the prayer becomes, help this man, please, Pop, kill him. Kill him. He needs killing. It's going to be good for everyone. I think it'll be good for him too. So, for, and I know, I know that praying for people works for a lot of people. It just hasn't worked for me. I've had to sit down and take a look at the map of that resentment, the architecture of my sickness, resentments, defects of character, fear, and sexual misconduct. And one last note on all this. I believe that the more enlightenment you achieve, the more power that you gain. And I've seen it to be certainly true in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if one does not deliberately divest themselves of the power that you accrue through enlightenment, you will eventually become Swami Bagawinda. That will be your fate. And it is, it's a painful, interesting, joyful process to do this work, to get involved, to receive enlightenment, and then to gain power and say, I quit. There's a guy named Krishnamurti who was preened and prepared to be the leader of a group called the Theosophists. This was some years ago, pretty in the last 20, 30, 40 years. He was a guru. And he was a boy wonder, kind of a Dalai Lama-esque kind of figure. And they groomed him to take control of this group. And when he finally came to his own and took control of the group, he brought the group together and disbanded it. I love Krishnamurti. I love that idea. The reason why I'm saying this is that I have started groups where I've really instituted this work through sponsorship, and the group has become about this work. And I've quit. I've started three groups that I've quit because they've turned this 10-step work and this work into a god. And it's ugly. And they don't miss me. They're perfectly fine. They're very robust groups. They're growing. They're doing good. My new home group is five guys. So if you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to urge you, you know, if anybody puts their finger in your chest and says, this is the way AA is, I've just steered clear of those people. If you read the literature, if you read the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was founded by a bunch of niacin-eaten, acid-dropping, Ouija board playing wackos. I mean, it was really started by incredible, valiant seekers. You know, before Bill Wilson died, Earl Marsh, who wrote Doctor Heal Thyself, Physician Heal Thyself in the book, was going to India for the first time, and Bill said to him, see what you can find. Bring me back something. See what you can find. What are they doing? You know? That's what I want. And I've been hanging out with people with a lot of time in AA who are relentless seekers. They're not relentlessly uncomfortable. They're relentlessly seeking. And I pray that for you. Thanks so much for having me as your guest today.